Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this latest episode of the Physics World Weekly podcast. My name's Liz Callagher, and I edit Physics World Environment and Energy. This week, our podcast sees a climate takeover in honour of the Covering Climate Now project, which brings more than 220 media outlets together to boost their coverage of climate change in the 8 days up to the UN Climate Action Summit in New York on September the 23rd. We'll hear from two climate scientists, John Cook of George Mason University, about his work on consensus in climate science and why he needed to prove that climate change is real, and Daniela Schmidt of the University of Bristol on climate and the oceans. We also have a review of Robert McFarlane's prize-winning book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey, which looks, amongst other things, at a dark matter experiment deep beneath the Yorkshire coast and the legacy we're leaving in addition to climate change in the form of buried radioactive waste. In the spirit of keeping this podcast as low carbon as possible, we interviewed John Cook by phone, sent our multimedia consultant James Stacey up the hill to Bristol University by foot, and read a copy of Underland that we received in the mail. First, let's hear from John Cook across the pond on his 1 million download research paper. So I'm talking to John Cook, who's at the Centre for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Back in 2013, your paper on quantifying the consensus on anthropogenic global warming received a lot of attention, and since then it's received 1 million downloads, or more than 1 million downloads, I should say. Can you tell us why you decided to write that paper?
So back in 2013, it had been almost a year since Naomi Oreskes had written the very first paper quantifying the level of scientific agreement on human-caused global warming. And we thought, well, a decade has passed. I think it's our time to have another look at it and see whether the level of scientific agreement is still strong on human-caused global warming. And look at all the studies that have been published over the last 10 years. And we also thought, well, in order to actually get published, we're going to have to go a little bit further with our analysis than the original study. Like, we need to push forward the boundaries of knowledge. And so we just did a much bigger content analysis, looking at over 12,000 studies. Content analyzed the papers in much greater detail, and just trying to offer a more up-to-date picture on the level of scientific consensus on climate change.
And why did you feel there was a need to do that, given that Arrhenius, back at the end of the 19th century, first worked out that carbon dioxide would cause climate change? Why, more than 100 years later, was there still a need to look at that?
Unfortunately, there's a great need to do that. And the funny thing was, the comments we got from the scientific community in response to this research was, why are you even doing this? Like, we know that there's scientific consensus. We know that all the climate scientists agree on human-caused global warming. But when you ask the general public, do scientists agree on climate change, they're just not aware of it, or they certainly weren't aware of it back in 2013. And the reason they're not aware of it is primarily because of misinformation. Attacking the scientific consensus, casting doubt on the level of scientific agreement, has been one of the key focal points of climate misinformation. And it's been effective. In fact, there's a political memo published by a strategist, Frank Luntz, in 2002, which basically advised Republicans, if they want to win the policy debate about climate change, all they have to do is cast doubt on the consensus, and it's game over already. If people are confused about the level of scientific consensus, then they don't support climate policy. And so that's been a key strategy since then.
And what did your paper find about the consensus?
So we looked at around 12,000 abstracts. And one thing we were quite aware of, and because Naomi Oreskes predicted this in 2007, was that when there is a consensus, scientists are likely to mention the consensus position less and less over time. It's like if you look at astronomy papers these days, you don't see many astronomy papers citing the consensus position that the Earth revolves around the Sun. It's as it becomes more of a consensus, there's less need to mention it. So we expected to see a lot of papers not even bother mentioning human-caused global warming. But among the 4,000 papers that did mention human-caused global warming, we found that 97% of them endorsed that humans were causing global warming. The second thing we did was not rely just on our own content analysis of abstracts. We actually invited the authors of all these thousands of scientific papers to categorize their own research, because we figured who is a better expert on what a paper is trying to say than the actual scientists who wrote it. And what was striking about that independent method was when scientists categorized their own papers, we also found 97% consensus that humans were causing global warming.
And how was that work received at the time?
Well, we were just talking about this in the office at the Centre for Climate Change Communication yesterday about how scientific research gets received. And the big theme of the conversation was how important serendipity was. Because you can publish studies that are, you think are going to make a big splash and they don't. And then you can publish other studies that just come out at a certain time when the conditions are just right, and they can make a huge splash. In the case of our consensus study, it was published by coincidence just a few weeks before the Obama administration was about to unroll some policy about climate action. And so by coincidence, our paper came out, and then the next day, President Obama tweeted about that research, which then, precipitated a whole kind of cascading series of media attention, and then because of all the positive media attention that our study was getting, that then caused a backlash of criticisms and attacks on our research in order to try and discredit it. So overall, yeah, the paper made a big splash, mentioned in hundreds of media articles, mentioned by presidents and prime ministers around the world. And also, unfortunately, also attacked by a lot of prominent figures who denied the scientific consensus on climate change.
And that came out 6 years ago, that paper. How has the climate for climate change research and actually for climate change action changed since then?
One thing that I'm always trying to stress, particularly when people do try to criticize our research, is the fact that ours is not the only study to find scientific consensus on climate change. There were multiple studies before ours came out finding 97% consensus. There were other studies that came out after our study that also found scientific consensus, whether it was 97% or in the 90s. And so So one thing that's happened since the 6 years that our paper was published has been other consensus studies have been published, and they all confirm, replicate our results. I think that broadly speaking, that the public are becoming more aware of both the scientific consensus on climate change. Public awareness on consensus has been steadily going up over the last 6 years, and also along with that, just public awareness of the reality of climate change, that humans are causing it, the severity of climate impacts, public awareness of all those things are also going up, as well as support, public support for climate action. And so as well as the scientific consensus, we're seeing a social consensus is getting stronger over time.
Okay, because I guess that period of time we've seen things like the climate youth strikes and Extinction Rebellion start to come on board. How does that link to your work?
Well, I don't know if it directly links, but I think it's super important that young people are standing up and speaking in a clear, loud voice about the importance of climate change and the importance of us doing something about it, because they're the generation that are inheriting the world that we've created. So I'm really encouraged by all the student marches and the strikes and just the passion in young people for this issue. It's crucially important, and I hope that momentum only builds over time, and I think it will, because this issue is not going anywhere. It's climate change is only going to become more prominent, more dire over time, and so as a social issue, it can only become more prominent as well.
And a lot of our listeners are physicists. Do you have a particular range of actions you'd like to see from physicists?
From physicists? That's a good question. I have to think about that one. I think that some of the survey research that we've done here at the Centre for Climate Change Communication, and it's also mirrored by research done in Australia, I would guess that there's probably a similar dynamic in the UK, have found that the most trusted voice on climate change are university scientists. And so I think that means that scientists have a really important role to play in talking about this issue and raising awareness of the issue and just informing and educating people as well. Because they're such a respected and important voice. So I guess the contribution that scientists can make is just to talk about it. And in fact, I would say that applies to just the general public overall. One of the biggest problems about climate change and one of the biggest barriers to getting climate action is climate silence. In the US, our survey data finds that 52% of the public are either concerned or alarmed about climate change. So more than half of the public are on board and accept that climate change is a problem that we need to do something about. But most of those people, despite the fact that they're concerned about climate change, don't talk about it. There's this pervading climate silence. And the reason why we're silent is because of, I think, pluralistic ignorance. People are ignorant of the fact that they're in the majority. They think that a lot less people are concerned about climate change than is actually the case. And it's kind of a reinforcing spiral of silence. We don't hear other people talk about it, so we think that they don't care about it, and then we don't talk about it. And so it goes on and on and on. And so we need to break that silence, break that spiral, by opening our mouths and talking about it, whether it's talking with our friends and family, talking about it in as scientists who engage with the public or engage with talking to the media, and probably most importantly, in talking about this issue to elected officials and letting them know that we are concerned about climate change, we think that we should be doing something about it, and we vote accordingly. When politicians finally hear the public speak up about our concern about climate change, that's when I think you'll find that they will show leadership about it, because there's nothing that a politician cares more about than keeping their own job.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Next up, a scientist a bit closer to our offices here in Bristol. Although we didn't ask her this, we can be pretty sure that Daniela Schmidt agrees with the scientific consensus on climate change. James Dacey talked to her about oceans past and present.
I work on marine ecosystems, and specifically on trying to use both historical and geological records of climate change in the marine system to understand how organisms, individuals, and entire ecosystems respond to rapid climate change.
Perhaps, you know, to the general public, it's a bit easier to picture the impacts of rising temperatures or sea levels as opposed to the ocean becoming more acidic. I mean, can you perhaps explain in simple terms, you know, why it is that it gets more acidic as CO2 levels rise?
See, it's interesting. The concept of acidification is complicated, but the science of acidification of the ocean is much more simple than of warming of the world. Because warming of the world is different depending where you are. Ocean acidification happens because the CO2, which we are releasing into the atmosphere, is taken up by the ocean. Around a quarter of the CO2 which we have produced since the beginning of industrialization is in the ocean. And that's really important because otherwise our warming would be so much stronger. But it is a weak acid. So if you put lemon juice or vinegar into water, you're making it slightly acidic. And this uptake of the CO2 therefore changes the pH, which is the number of protons in the ocean. And it changes, therefore, the chemistry of the ocean. It makes it harder for organisms which build their shells out of carbonate to build these shells because they have to change that. On the other hand, if the organism living in the ocean is an algae, so something like a plant, then they benefit from the higher CO2 because it makes photosynthesis, the uptake of CO2 and building sugars much more easy.
So it's a bit of a trade-off, but at the moment, with the current rate of increase of CO2, is that balance has been tipped out of equilibrium? Is that the risk at the moment?
It is, but it's important to consider that even an opportunity for an organism to do better under higher CO2 because it photosynthesizes better changes the composition of an ecosystem. So if you produce lots and lots more organic matter, so that's the product of taking up the CO2 and photosynthesizing, then the problem is that you're producing much more organic matter which also sinks to the bottom of the sea. And if you do that, then it will decay somewhere, and the decay process is the reverse, it will take up oxygen. And so there will be less oxygen in parts of the ocean as well. Mm-hmm. Secondly, ecosystems have been in balance for a long time. The Holocene, our last 12,000 years of Earth history, have been comparably stable. And so organisms are used to having their food at a specific time of year and in a specific composition. So if the fish suddenly gets a different organism as food, it is not necessary that the fish can eat it that well. Or in a more complex food web, there's the algae photosynthesizing, and then there are smaller organisms which eat them, and then they are eaten by fish, so small things are eaten by big things. And so if we're changing that food chain, we're also changing how organisms higher up the food chain will react, such as the bigger fish or the sharks. So any change in the system takes time to adapt to. And as you said, the really important thing about ocean acidification and warming at the moment is the incredibly fast rate of change. Fast rate of change is very little time to adapt.
I mean, I guess the sort of flagship ecosystem that gets impacted is in fact coral reefs. You know, you do hear about acidification in relation to that. But are there any particular species where, if there is an impact, that then has a particularly magnified effect going up the food chain because it's a really sort of crucial organism?
They are really important species. We call them keystone species, who are fundamentally important. But it's also really important to recognize that ocean acidification is not just something for the future. Ocean acidification is happening now. So, for example, the oyster fisher and the scallop fishers along the west coast of the United States are already recognizing now that they have upwellings, so transport up to the surface of CO2-rich waters, which takes out their entire hatcheries. Mm. And it doesn't just take them out because their food is changing, but also because the chemistry is changing so much that the larvae can't deal with it. By working together as a scientist and a producer, what we can do is we can switch off the water going into the hatcheries at a specific time, let them just live in the water as it is there, and switch it on again when the ocean acidification event has stopped. In the future, this is a luxury we won't have because ocean acidification will be around all the time. Mm-hmm. The upscaling, we know a lot about how individual species respond. It's much harder because we have understood now that species respond differently because they have different needs, as well as respond differently in different regions. It's quite hard to go from those individual species to the entire ecosystem. And that's one of the challenges we're currently facing. The other challenge which is really difficult for us is ocean acidification doesn't happen in isolation. So there's warming, there's acidification, and in some regions of the world there's also a loss of oxygen. Mm-hmm. What happens if these all come together?
Are there any geoengineering solutions that could maybe help to mitigate some of the worst impacts?
There's a number of suggestions out in the world. So the question is, do we really want to put giant mirrors in space and reflect the sunlight? If we do that, it doesn't help with ocean acidification at all, because that's the CO2 going into the ocean directly. So then the other methodologies, some of the others have, are about removal of CO2. 10 years ago, we talked a lot about carbon capture and storage. So taking the carbon out at the point source, so let's say at a power plant, and then putting it back into the reservoirs where we've got the carbon out to start with, which is oil and gas fields. And that's highly beneficial for the oil and gas companies because it increases the pressure inside. But it also causes cracks in the rock which stores it. It appears to be more complicated than we think to do that. Recently, there's been a suggestion for a bioengineering approach, and that is to build millions and millions and millions of trees. Mm. And absolutely right. This is how one of the ways Earth regulates this is the uptake of CO2 by plants. But we need to think about where we can do this, what ecosystems we are destroying it if we're building forests everywhere, that growing a forest takes decades of time as well, and that a forest is very different in the way how it modulates the climate than, for example, an icy, frozen, snow-covered soil of tundra in Siberia. So yes, we could plant lots of trees there, but they don't reflect as much sunlight as the snow does, which is currently there. And so while they benefit, they don't have the same benefit because they don't reflect and change, therefore, the Earth's albedo. So there are lots of ideas around, and some of them are great. Because planting trees where they used to be is a good thing. Although it would be nicer if we would start with protecting the forests we already have and not burning them down. And that's not just happening in Brazil. It's also happening in lots of other places in the world.
Looking at local coastal ecosystem, if you were to plant marine grasses, for example, is that something that could help, or is it literally a bit of a drop in the ocean if the wider ocean is still being sort of badly affected on a larger scale?
There's planting seagrasses is our options, planting kelp, because kelp can also be used later on, because kelp is harvested, right? Whenever you eat your nori, there are options which we can do. We need to think about, for example, we have marine protected areas around the UK. They might be protected because it is really beautiful kelp meadow, and then you want to keep that. They could also be protected because they have other organisms. And then if you build those, if you incentivize the kelp to grow there, then they will take so much light away because they're so successful that other organisms will not live there. It's really important that we think about what's the right place and the right action. But you're absolutely right. Seagrasses, kelp can help with both drawing down the CO2 and therefore also the local acidification and make that setting a better place for other organisms to live.
So now with the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement and obviously the IPCC study since, there's been a lot of talk about limiting warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels versus 1.5 degrees. So in terms of, that's obviously connected with the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Is in your field in ocean acidification, is there a clear difference in the scale of impact between those two different levels?
There is, but it depends on the species and it depends on the group. So as I said, there's some, for example, to go back to the previous oyster hatcheries, if you're looking at the adult species, it can deal with a large change in pH. Mm-hmm. And that is because you think about where you find oysters, they're somewhere at the coast, they are exposed to parts of the tide, and therefore they have an ability to deal with a large variability. The larvae doesn't. If you go to cold water corals living in the deep depths of the ocean, they have shown to be able, if they have sufficient food, to internally change their chemistry to deal with acidification. The tropical coral doesn't do that that well. And so there's a clear difference for the survival of the coral reefs, if we're thinking of the large things like the Great Barrier Reef, between 1.5 and 2. Mm-hmm. And again, it needs to be seen as a not just one driver. If you're looking at the Great Barrier Reef, the warming increases the frequency of bleaching. The changes to our atmospheric system might have impacts on El Niño. There is the acidification of the ocean, plus there's a change in how we use the land around it, and therefore how much material is transported down the rivers, and also stresses. So it's really important to think about both local solutions people can suggest, which they can work on, versus the national global solutions we need to be able to to reduce CO2 to level which have a lower impact on our ecosystem.
So obviously there's the UN Climate Action Summit coming up. I mean, sort of realistically, what do you think is the best possible outcome from that?
I think most nations are nowadays accepting that climate change is happening. Mm-hmm. And some nations already can see impacts of climate change now. It is really important that we move on from discussing about climate change to actions about limiting it. And we need to do that on three different levels. We need to consider what the big nations can do and the international agreements. We need to think about big companies and how they can change their behaviour. And then, of course, of our own behaviour. Mm-hmm. So an action plan where the nations are really committing to do things differently is what is needed.
So I think the call really from the UN Secretary General is for nations to arrive with clear plans as to how they can implement that before 2020. Are you confident that there will be clear outcomes from that?
But even if a nation has a plan, the United Kingdom has a climate change adaptation plan. So the Committee for Climate Change scrutinises the UK government's climate change adaptation plan. The Committee for Climate Change called this insufficient. To be more explicit to the UK part of the audience, they're called the Dad's Army. And so what is the point in having those plans? What's the point in declaring climate emergencies, which are cities doing all over the world, if there aren't actions we're really committing to? Then it's not worth the paper it's written on.
So at the moment, is it really just a high-level statement about, I think it's going carbon net neutral by 2050, isn't it? But you're saying there's just not the detail within that to actually make it happen.
But it's not just the government, it's us as well, right? Mm. So we're all claiming that we want to do things for the environment. And if you think about any individual, we are thinking about food, travel, and heating for our house. Mm. Where are we making the changes? Where are we merely making those implementations? I think everyone talks about wanting to do something. Where are we making those differences? You know, are governments investing into renewable energies? Are they investing in decentralizing some of the energy systems? Are they looking into improving transport? And that's shipping as well. Are there incentives and benefits for companies to do those changes? There are lots of ideas people have, but we really need to start implementing those. Mm-hmm. And in the UK, there are large areas where we could use wind energy. But there's also a lot of opposition against what it does to the landscape. There are potential to use tidal energy. I'm based in Bristol, and the Severn next to us has the second highest tidal lab in the world. It was declined to build infrastructure there to harvest that energy, but it was accepted to build a nuclear power plant. Mm. Nuclear power plant is always considered to be, low in carbon. There's a huge amount of concrete going into building one of those. And also, there's a huge amount of aftercare needed even after they work. Mm-hmm. So we need to think about those options and have a critical debate about what we want to do. Because otherwise we will be talking in a decade about, are we willing to abandon East Anglia? Mm-hmm. Are we willing to abandon Somerset? Are we building dikes? If we're building dikes, and it clearly can be done because the Dutch are doing it very well, then again we need to talk about the land by the coast and what we do. It's time for action now. It's time to stop talking.
Now it's time to travel, but only in our imaginations, from the earth to what lies beneath. Ian Dale Trotter tells Hamish Johnston about Robert McFarlane's latest book, Underland.
I'm Hamish Johnston, and I'm chatting with Ian Dale Trotter, who is a publisher here at IOP Publishing, which also publishes Physics World. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, you've written a review for Physics World about a new book from Robert McFarlane that's called Underland, A Deep Time Journey. Now, I'm guessing that this book is going to be something about the science of all things underground. Is that right? What is the book about?
So it really is, it's looking at how humanity interacts with the spaces beneath the Earth. So really looking at the science that we're doing underground, the science of the underground, both biological and geological, but also how these spaces have affected humanity, affected us in our culture and psychologically, and also how we are beginning to affect it through our activities. So it's really looking at all aspects of how we interact with the the underground.
And I think you start your review with a bit of physics, and you talk about the Boulby Mine, which I think is that in North Yorkshire?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's a really it's really great. The book seems to kind of be bookended by some really good bits of physics, which was really helpful for my review. The Boulby Mine has quite a few different experiments in it at the moment, but one of the main ones is the drift detector, which is looking for dark matter candidates, looking for WIMPs at the moment, weakly interacting massive particles, and it's able to detect. It's theoretically able to detect some directional information as well. So the description of the physics in this bit of the book is really fantastic. It doesn't shy away from the physics and from the terminology. It's just about as thorough as many other kind of dedicated popular physics books. Quite concise, but it introduces dark matter candidates, introduces neutrinos, explains why they're so weakly interacting. But puts that in context with some really poetic and beautiful writing. Talks about the drift detector as being a cosmic breath catcher, and then talking about how we are wide meshed nets and thinking about particles as being quick fish and catching them. So it's really, really beautiful writing.
I mean, it is interesting because, of course, you think of underground as being a very quiet place and being a very dark place. And, of course, that's what it's like in terms of particle physics. Mm. You're so deep underground that almost all radiation, cosmic radiation, for example, doesn't reach the detectors. And it's only the dark matter or neutrinos that can sort of go through anything that get down there. So it is interesting.
Yeah, it's really an ideal place. I mean, so much of the terrestrial kind of astroparticle physics and particle physics is done underground for that very reason. So any experiment looking at astroparticles, looking at neutrinos, they're all underground. So there's other ones around the world, Hyperkamikande in Japan, and there's a Dune experiment in North America. It's anything that is looking for low event searches, proton decay, things like that, it has to be underground, to avoid the gamma background. So it really lent itself really well to the subject of this book.
But it's not only physics that McFarlane covers. He also talks about a broad range of human activity underground. What are some other things that he talks about?
Well, yeah, it really covers because almost every way that we touch the underground, and every science really is represented here. One quite early interesting bit of information is a chapter about the wood wide web, so the fungal network connecting trees within forests, and really the work that discovered this now changes our perception of forests into one communicating an organism rather than individual objects.
Right, yeah, we had an interesting story on that recently where somebody looked at how I think it was almond trees in California communicate with each other, and somehow the entire orchard of almond trees decides this is going to be a great year for almonds, or nah, we're not going to produce that many almonds. And apparently they're doing it underground via their roots and through microorganisms. It's wow. Fantastic stuff, really yeah. Interesting.
And I think it's great. You know, they it really it goes into some information about how the forests and collections of plants within woods and copses really behave as a society as well. You know, there's not so much competition for resources, and everything is quite you know, contrary to the survival of the fittest, the approach that we're used to thinking about nature. So that's really, really interesting. He also mentions, you know, it's a really gothic and dramatic part of the book when he delves into the Parisian catacombs, the shadow city beneath Paris, which was initially created by limestone quarries to try and keep up with the expansion of Paris, and before the authorities were able to really get a handle on the extent to the mining, you know, the whole of almost the whole of the north half of Paris is entirely supported by, you know, a shadow city of quarries, and they really have, there's really not any good mapping or knowledge of the extent of these. So there's a huge kind of off the grid shadow society of cavers and people exploring these, you know, quite illegally. But it's a really interesting chapter in the book, far beyond, you know, anybody who's gone to see the bone, the official kind of catacomb tour. I was amazed, you know, I've done that, but I was amazed to find out, you know, quite just how far this this cave network goes underneath Paris. So.
And I think McFarlane also talks about how sort of current human activity will affect what's underground in the future. What's that about, this idea of the Anthropocene?
Yeah, so that was really a theme that ran through the book and really seemed to haunt McFarlane. He returns to it quite often. He introduced it very early on in the book you know, as the new age, as the new geological era, which can be defined. You know, we're finally having a lasting impact on the fossil record and the, you know, geological strata, and also leaving behind nuclear waste and remnants from nuclear weapons testing and nuclear energy that will far outlast you know, the offshoots of, you know, previous societies within, you know, human history.
So does that mean in a few million years people will be digging a hole and they'll come across a layer of plastic?
Yeah.
And say, aha, I can date this to the late 20th century.
I think that's the idea, is that the geological record will be forever changed, you know, by what we're doing at the moment. So we was really, really haunted by that idea. You know, there's a very kind of emotional trip that he takes to the Nud Rasmussen Glacier in Greenland, and explores that with some friends of his, and really just looking at the ice carving from the glacier and the melt and the retreat of the glacier, you know, is really affected by quite how much we are affecting such, you know, colossal permanent features of the planet that we thought were you know unchangeable by such, you know, small beings as humans, but we're really having very visible effects on them. So it's very kind of haunted by that.
So is that the main message of the book? Or I'm hoping there's a bit of upbeat bit of an upbeat takeaway.
There
as
is,
well.
Yeah. I think that's his main message. Really, it's because it's from you know, from the physics aspects, from looking at the astroparticle and the experiments underground, you know, thinking about remnants from the Big Bang and thinking about the beginning of the universe, and then looking at the deep future and thinking about what will be left of our civilization in terms of nuclear remnants in the deep future. He says that it's it gives us this kind of deep time perspective. Humans have very short lifespans, but we're starting to, you know, see both the beginning and potentially, you know, towards the end of the universe, or at least far beyond, you know, any of our lifespans. And it gives us this deep time perspective. He says it's very easy to, you know, once you have this type of perspective, to see our lives as, you know, insignificant and, you know, kind of, or pointless, or anything that we could do couldn't possibly change or impact anything on those timescales. But he urges the readers to think about it slightly differently, and to try and think of themselves as being good ancestors. You know, we will hand down the planet to those coming after us. And really, that's really the positive message. I think it's just to be mindful that we can change, the Earth on a global scale, and just think about the type of planet that we'd like to leave for our children, and for the civilizations and the species that come after us.
And McFarlane also talks about our relationship with places underground, with natural caves, and also caverns that we've dug out ourselves. And it's not always been a positive relationship, has it?
No, there's some of the most affecting sections of the book are talking about the karst plateau between Italy and Slovenia, and how this collection of caves, this part of the part of Europe is on some stone which is very soluble, so there's this entire plateau is really holy, like cheese, and these spaces have been used in times of war and in the sectarian violence between the communities on either side of the border after the Second World War, and it's really interesting to meditate on how these types of places can be haunted and affected by, kind of imbued with this violence and this menace, and that there's a local word called a foiber, which describes a sinkhole in the karst, and it's now synonymous with a hole that's been used for as a mass grave or as an object of killing, which is really quite haunting.
So was it a well-written book, Ian? Did you enjoy reading it?
Yeah, I think, not only is his, is his descriptions of places and nature, they're really beautifully written, but, for anybody, slightly ambivalent about nature writing, I'd really recommend it, because everywhere is really rooted with characters and people. You know, he brings humanity to all of the landscapes, and really, it's a very emotive and the writing is really filled with humans, and some of the writing, some of the descriptions of scenes are filled with metaphors drawn from physics as well. There was a
so is he a physicist? Is that why there's
not
so much physics?
No,
in there?
I think he was just really taken by some of the imagery from his Borby visit, because he describes Cherenkov radiation in the detectors, and then much later on in the book, describes the blue of an underground river as Cherenkov blue, and a lot of the underground spaces, there's a lot of black hole illusion. So we really and optical and material physics references and similes and metaphors when talking about light through glaciers. So it's really physics and is the language of physics, and the imagery of physics is really runs through it. So it's really there's got plenty for physicists to enjoy.
Well, that's definitely a thumbs up for Robert McFarlane's Underland from Ian Dale Trotter. You can read Ian's review on the website. It's called We Shall Inherit the Earth. Thanks for joining us, Ian.
No problem. Thanks very much, Hamish.
And that concludes our climate change takeover. If you'd like to see more of our news, opinion and analysis for Covering Climate Now, including what climate scientists think about the recent rise in activism and a call for physicists to declare a climate emergency, check out the physicsworld.com homepage or look for the Covering Climate Now hashtag over on Twitter. Thanks to John Cook, Daniela Schmidt and Ian Dale Trotter for speaking to us, to James Stacey for walking up Park Street, and a special thank you to our producer, Callum Gell. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also now available on Spotify, so you can follow us there too. And thanks to you for listening. Please do join us again next week when the podcast will be back to normal, covering a range of physics topics. Physics World.